Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International IDEA. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today with democracy around the world.
Hello, and welcome to International IDEA's new podcast, Democracy Ideas. My name is Leena Rikkilä-Tamang. I'm director of Asia and the Pacific Regional Program. As part of the broader podcast, I'm doing a segment focused on democratic functions in the time of the COVID-19 pandemic called Democracy 6 Feet Apart. This series will examine innovative methods on political mobilizing, campaigning, civic advocacy, and civic resistance during the time of a pandemic. What can MPs, parties, civic actors, and movements do to reach people? And how can people participate in the democratic process with social distancing in place? Hopefully, this pod will inspire others by providing some creative examples and lessons learned. Today, I'm discussing with Janet Pang, a young solicitor in Hong Kong who is helping protesters pro bono. She has just been elected to the Law Society, which is a self-regulatory body of solicitors in Hong Kong. However, in this podcast, Janet is speaking in her personal capacity. On when it comes to pandemic, Hong Kong was one of the first places impacted by the COVID-19 and the subsequent measures, including restrictions on freedom of movement and freedom of assembly were put in place, disabling the street demonstrations. At the end of this May, China's National People's Congress approved controversial national security legislation for the island. Some predict that public gatherings to criticize the one-party system will no longer be allowed if the law takes effect. In addition, Hong Kong has the Legislative Council elections scheduled for September 2020. I'm so glad to have Janet here to discuss all this.
Thank you for having me, Leena.
Janet, I would like to start by asking about the current state of democracy movement. The 2019 demonstrations sparked by the draft bill that would have allowed extradition from Hong Kong to China and which eventually brought a million people to the street to demand for more democracy and scrutiny came to a halt due to COVID-19 restrictions and obvious health concerns. How is the movement mobilizing now? Have the activists shifted to online, or has this been a time to recuperate and restore energies?
Sure. Nina, just to add a bit of more context to your question. In short, the COVID-19 did put some pauses to our year-long struggle and protest for democracy in Hong Kong. It was first started as a movement to oppose an extradition bill, which is very technical, but it lifts the firewall of the two system between Hong Kong and China. But then as young people go out to protest, as the entire Hong Kong are so worried about the rule of law and the unique system in Hong Kong, the movement turned into a greater pursuit for democracy, for universal suffrage, which has been promised it very clearly in our constitution called the Basic Law. So from January to now, of course, it's well known that COVID-19 has spread from China to everywhere to the world, including Hong Kong. So it's not as serious in Hong Kong as we Hong Kongers had the experience of SARS in 2003, and everyone was so nervous, and we carefully wear our masks until today, so that the virus has been maintained. But you are right that our protest has sort of mellowed down, because it's not desirable to go out so much anymore, and there has been regulation which put a stop on public gathering from four people in early time on, and now it's up to eight people. So any group gathering with this size would be issued with a penalty notice of around $250. So you're right about that the protest has died down a bit, but what I observe and what I experience myself is that the movement has spread into every sphere of our life. When I talk about it, as we had this year-long struggle, so far nearly 9,000 protesters, particularly young people around the age of 20 to 30, have been arrested by the police. And over 1,800 of them have been prosecuted and brought to court. Over 600 have been prosecuted with rioting charges, which can take up to 10 years imprisonment. So the average would be 3 to 4 years. So definitely the consequences of this past year protest to us has been serious and dire, especially to our youngsters. But people, I would say that people have been trying to fight against this authoritarian rule with other means. For example, one way we have evolved as a means of protest, it's on the economy. So now we have some kind of economy called the yellow economy. What it does mean, it means that people tend to go to restaurants and shops which support the democratic movement. For example, when I was joining some protests, some peaceful protests in previous months, some shops and restaurants near the protest area would hand out water, and they would put up posters, they put up signs which support democratic movement, and they would be known as the yellow restaurant, the liberal restaurant, the restaurant and shops that support the democracy movement. So people would then go back to this restaurant every day to support their livelihood. And this is how I would say a very innovative way to the world, and how we can live out the democratic campaign every day. We don't have to go out to protest every day, but we can use other means to support people, companies, and businesses, especially with COVID-19 and with the increasing policing that the government has been using, and especially that there have been obvious police use of excessive force, but there's not so much of prosecution and consequence on that side. But at the same time, you see over nearly 9,000 protesters have been arrested. So how we have evolved it through this very difficult struggle is that we spread democratic movement to every bit of our life, including going to restaurant, shopping, including we put up on Facebook, including all elections, which I will further talk about it later.
Oh, that is so interesting. And I understand already before the COVID-19, the activists were enormously creative. There were these creative songs and apps and videos, building a whole protest culture. And as you said, now moving it into all spheres of life. Have this kind of other online activities, keeping in touch with each other. I understand it's been part of the protest movement toolbox already much before the pandemic. But and has that continued as well?
Yes, yeah, certainly. You're right on the point that we Hong Kong people are very resourceful, especially young people, especially designers who share the same values. Everyone is doing, it's having a role in the democratic movement according to their expertise and profession. So what we see is it's a lot of creative work. We have now our own protest songs, many of that. We have many videos made by very talented authors and young people. And everyone just use their own talent to help. And one thing that we have been using since in Hong Kong, we are very fortunate that we still have freedom of internet. We still can go online, we can browse, we can speak in a way which China doesn't allowed in the mainland. So we have been using that a lot, and it's also that we Hong Kong people are pretty fluent in English, so we can utilize our skills. And what we have been doing, and I have been doing myself too, is the use of media platform like Twitter. If you have we get some statistics, for example, from Twitter, is that since the movement, the jump in Hong Kong users in Twitter has been quite a leap. So we're using all kinds of means to spread our movement, to spread our pursuit to the world. And these are not materials made by very famous writer or very well-known and very senior singers or authors, but it's everyone's work. Everyone shared their bit of love and their bit of pursue, their bit of idea on Hong Kong and spread it around.
Thanks. And of course, we know Protestant demonstrations were never straightforward in Hong Kong. Can you talk about the legal framework regulating the peaceful protests in Hong Kong, and how you were able to work around that?
Sure. A bit of background. So Hong Kong, it's a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. But I would say a somewhat not as well protected or adequately protected right to protest according to international human rights standards. What I mean is that the United Nations has commented on the Hong Kong legal framework for a long time and push for improvement. If we want to go out for protests or assembly or march, although this is a constitutional right which we should be entitled to, there is a need to for a no objection letter. So this is tricky. So no objection letter, meaning you have to apply for a license, but it's not labeled as an application approved or an approval, because this is a constitutional right. But this has been criticized for a long time, but our court case a few years ago actually legitimized this framework. Yet in recent protests, we have seen the government and police this no objection letter framework to suppress the protests. So they would, when citizens, when residents of Hong Kong would like to apply for no objection letter for some kind of protest, the police would say, oh, given the COVID-19 situation and the possible violence that might break out due to past protest experience, I'm not issuing a no objection letter to you anymore. So this means actually a ban on protest. And so far there in the past year, as I read from the news, there are over 50 of these kind of protests being banned. And this is not ideal because according to international human rights standards, individuals should be entitled, it is a right to peaceful protest, and the government and police should facilitate peaceful protest instead of using vague and uncertain reason to put a ban on it. So this is the context behind. And as very recently, the June 4th It's been the June 4th, 31st century. The organizer for this long-term protest and gathering has applied for a no objection letter, but they got rejected. And what happened was that people still go out because it's such a big thing. It's such a distinctive assembly that we have for over for 31 years, which make ourselves different from China. Many people still, the old and the young, still insist to attend the assembly at Victoria Park, which is very significant. So what happened was that the police calmed day. The government also spread a message around Hong Kong that, oh, so today the police won't be heavily patrolling. They are used to, and they will use their discretion and all that. But this is not desirable because people who attend this protest without a no objection letter technically are still in breach of law. So the police and the government can come back to them months later and say, oh, you have broken the law and now I'm going to arrest you and take you to the court. So this is not desirable because there are a lot of discretion with the police and the government. And also from past experience, on in mid-April, we have very famous pro-democracy politicians, including Martin Lee, Margaret Ng, and lawyers Albert Ho, and others, 15 of them, who were arrested.
So how will this national security legislation change the situation? Do you think it is possible that any public gatherings to criticize, particularly the ones criticizing one party system, will no longer be allowed if the law takes effect?
It's a very important question. It's a question that Hong Kong people and even lawyers cannot answer at the moment because of very uncertain framework and uncertain wording and provisions that the national security laws will entail. So far, what's been done is that the National People's Congress of China has announced that a decision to implement such a legislation directly to Hong Kong, and this is actually not compatible with the idea and principle of one country, two systems, and an express provision in our basic law in the Hong Kong Mini Constitution, which says that national security legislation should be introduced by Hong Kong itself. It's the famous Article 23 in our basic law. So this is such a big blow to one country, two system in Hong Kong, and the promise that being made to the UK and the rest of the world in 1980s and especially 1997 during the handover. And the beauty of one country, two system should be that we preserve our common law system inherited from the British with human rights principle built in and constitutional rights, and of course I would say constitutionalism, but Beijing doesn't see it this way. So this is such a clash in Hong Kong, and so far the situation is uncertain because the law have not been actualized yet, and we are very worriedly waiting for the actual form of the law and how it will implement. It's also very uncertain. For example, the National People's Congress decision said state agencies can be set up in Hong Kong, but our basic law says no state officials should execute or carry out their duties in the Hong Kong special administrative region. So there is such a clear clash between the two systems, and honestly, we are very worried, but we hope that first the Beijing would reconsider their decision, and secondly, if they really have to implement such a law directly to Hong Kong, then it has to be in accordance with human rights principles, international human rights principles, and the jurisdiction of Hong Kong courts, and it should be left with local authorities to execute the law. And we are very worried about whether especially an idea alone, for example, criticizing one party would be a violation of law. And truly, I cannot give you a concrete answer now, but we will co-question, and we hoped and we asked international communities and intergovernmental bodies like you, IDEA, to closely monitor the Hong Kong situation.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I was about to ask about that, the role of international community. We know that many Western countries have condemned the security legislation and also considering measures to respond. What's your view? Do you think Western sanctions, such as revoking possibly Hong Kong's privileges, would they strengthen pro-democracy forces in Hong Kong, or can they rather toughen Beijing's stance and reduce the scope for any negotiated outcome?
Yeah, I would say that any move by the international community, which is driven by our values of democracy, rule of law, human rights, these universal values that we human beings should pursue, are critical to our survival and existence in Hong Kong, and critical to our struggle for democracy and to preserve our very unique legal system based on the rule of law and common law principles, which are different from China. It is sad that Hong Kong would become a victim out of maybe international politics and all that. But as Hong Kong people, I believe that with our high civil virtues and our resistance, our strength, our wisdom, we just have to keep our fights, and we have to think about ways to continue with our fight. And this, I believe, is the shared goal among Hong Kong people, especially the younger generation, because we know that these values are important, not to only us because we're Hong Kong people, but because we are human.
Hong Kong is also now preparing for September's Legislative Council, and the polls are underway, public health conditions permitting. The elections will be held on September 6th. And I understand Hong Kong's pro-democracy camp has very high hopes for another landslide victory in reference to November's district council elections. But how are the candidates and parties preparing now? Do you think these elections will go ahead? Should they go ahead?
So, just a few hours ago, the Hong Kong government announced that the coming Legislative Council election that you just talked about will be carried out on the 6th of September. So officially, it will go ahead. So far, in past elections, in the November District Council election, we had seen a landslide win by the pro-democracy camp. I would say that this is the most peaceful way one can express its dissatisfaction with the government, is to use to exercise their vote, their constitutional right to say no to what the government has been doing. And I believe that the majority of Hong Kong people will think the same way for the coming September election. But since electoral election will be closely monitored by Beijing, and one thing that they have been doing since 2016 is to use legal means, use judicial process to disqualify, to defranchise candidates who promote ideas which they don't like, including, for example, independence and self-determination. This is completely unsatisfactory, and this is a blatant violation of international human rights principles, the Hong Kong's people's right to participate in public affairs. So far, what the pro-democracy camp has been doing, since we are under we're not under a first-past-the-post electoral framework for legislative council election, but a much more complicated proportional representative framework, which a high degree of coordination is needed so that we send as pro-democracy politicians into the legislature as possible. So far, peoples have been different candidates, different parties who will share the same value on democracy have been talking a lot, have been coordinating, have been talking about ideas of pre-election.
Thank you. Those are certainly elections for all of us to keep a close eye on, all those risks that you pointed out on what it comes to approving the candidacy and so on. But it's fascinating to hear all these various voting strategies that people have been thinking about. I mean, you're really making the best out of the system, of the far from perfect system, to do what you can. But isn't it right that it is only half of the council that is actually 50% of the council that is actually elected, and one of the demands is this universal suffrage?
Absolutely on the point. Our legislation has a very complicated framework behind, where we have 70 legislators in total. 35 of them are elected by geographical community. So what it means is it's the usual kind of returned by district, where each citizen, each permanent resident in Hong Kong has a vote. At the same time, the other 35 people are returned by functional constituency. This is a setup. This is set up by the British government before the handover, where they try to keep the balance of business influence and people who are in high society, their influence in politics. But this has been also used by Beijing to keep their power in the legislature, even though over 60%, past voting records have shown that over 60% of votes come from pro-democracy voters. So how they keep it that the other half, which are returned by functional constituency, some legislators are returned by professionals, for example, lawyers altogether, around 7,000 of them can elect one who has the same power as those who from the millions who elected one representative from their district. So that's the imbalance. So lawyers have one representative, but there are also corporates and businesses which they, with a very small circle of voters, they can have one representative who have also as one returned by millions of voters in geographical constituency. There are only 100 of them. They have one representative, but fishing industry has basically died out in Hong Kong. Insurance, business, some trade unions and all that. So that part of the legislature is much more complicated, but this is the framework which keeps Beijing's power in the legislature. Yet, in the coming election, people are finding to break through this unequaled and distorted electoral system. And for example, one legislator would come from the catering and restaurant industry. And many restaurants, especially the yellow restaurant, which I talked about just now, have been registering as voter so that they might be able to support the liberal candidate to be elected. So the coming election would be very fierce, and Beijing would keep an eye on that because as we have assessed and calculated, there is a possibility that liberal and pro-democracy candidates will become the majority in the legislature.
Thank you so much for that explanation. I think that's a very important background to understand the what is at stake in these legislative council elections and how it all actually works. Finally, Janet, where do you see the democracy movement going from here?
It's such a question that I have been asking myself, and I'm sure Hong Kong people and the world have been asking themselves. I always share with people that if I know the way to succeed, then we wouldn't be having so many struggles. If some leader, some maybe like Joshua Wong, he knows a way to successfully pursue democracy for Hong Kong, then we wouldn't be in so much debate and sometimes frustrations. I truly believe that democracy, the rule of law, human rights, equality are all shared values we have with the rest of the world, and these values will not change. We'll fight hard. I don't see Hong Kong people backing down, but I only see Hong Kong people finding different ways to express themselves, coordinated with international communities on our pursuit for democracy. Because this is not only for us, but for the rest of the world, since it's not only in Hong Kong that the rule of law and democracy have been are facing serious threats. We see many problems even in Western worlds that leaders who are more tend towards the popularism tendency, that they are also finding ways to get around the law, to abuse the law in their political favor. So we truly believe that this is not our fight for ourselves only, but for the future of humankind. And we just have to keep our conversations open, keep our dialogues open to rest of the world, to people who share same beliefs as we do, and we just have to keep fighting. So it's in a way it's aware because of dire threats that we are facing, the many prosecutions, the many youngsters might suffer by being sent to prisons, and the really harsh national security law is just 1 or 2 months. But at the same time, it's also going somewhere, because this value will not die in our heart, and we'll just keep on. I don't think we can go back, so we'll find ways. We just have to keep keep our conversations open. We just have to keep debating on ideas. We just have to keep learning from the rest of the world as well, and keep in close collaboration on movement, on for example, the movement now in the UK and the US for equality. We just have to keep our fight, and hopefully universal values will prevail in the world.
So thank you so much, Janet, and I wish you and the democracy movement all the best in the struggle, and we hope to be able to be of your support.
Thank you for your time, and keep following International IDEA on social media. We can be found on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.